Blog Talk Radio.
I'm a truth terrorist. I'm a knowledge gangster. I'm a black history hitman. I'm a lie killer, urban gorilla. I gotta be a roughneck.
Free the Black Panthers. FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers. F up the black police. That 13th Amendment. Trying to make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free. Okay, free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here, up coin tail pro. Show, they got me started, lying hearted, I'm the new Mufasa. And I'm all about Umoja, first in Gruz Usaba. Let's bring back the black families, we need our father. Single mama, son and daughter, that's root of the problem. Wise up, we rise up, unity is so powerful. Black banks, black schools, black owned, black power moves. You telling lies, if you think this shit's gonna be televised. Black power, be scared guys, they be standing there like they paralyzed, huh? We say fuck the system, cause we above the system. We keep ARs and pistols, shotguns that's worth the crystal. But that's for self-defense, make sure we have no issues. Be sure to leave it at the door if you have it with you. This for them freedom fighters, that lost their freedom. Until they freedom, we screaming carpe diem. This for the general, King Khalid Muhammad. We gon' make your day a holiday, I fuck me promise.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment, tryna make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free. Okay, Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here, up coin tail pro.
RBG, 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 RBG. My sisters, my brothers, the council, the elders, cause that's really all I need. We suited, we booted, don't do it, you stupid, we head to the armory. Black women and goddess, regardless, my heart just don't fuck with misogyny. Bullshit, I don't tolerate it. Melanated, so you gotta hate it. Barack upped up another conversation. Trump finna get inaugurated, damn. Unify or die, NBPP.org.
First and foremost, the new Black Panther Party, no other Black Panther Party, we are not violent. We are for self-defense and self-determination. The most violent group in this country are the police. What is taking place by the police departments to black people across this country is ethnic cleansing and genocide. It has escalated since the day that Barack Obama was inaugurated in 2008. We have a people who are only 13% of the population, yet we make up 80% of the prisons. We have 50% unemployment rate in the black community, and it's actually even more than that because they're not counting our people that are in the prison. The 13th Amendment says you cannot be made a slave or indentured servant unless you commit a crime. The 14th Amendment forced our people to be subjects of this government. We never had any say in that. We need our own nation. Black power, black power, black power, black power, brothers and sisters. You are listening to the new Black Panther Party for Self-Defense nightly broadcast, coming to you live here in the belly of the beast in America, KKK. But broadcasting all over the planet Earth, we want to dedicate tonight. It's going to be a political education recap. What we're going to do, we're going to play a compilation of black doctors, scientists, organizers, as well as great attorneys that are going to speak on some of the key issues that are going on that we're dealing with right now. Of course, we're going to address what's going on with the medical apartheid that is taking place as it relates to the so-called medical industry. And we're going to tie it in by hearing some words of power from the Queen, who's done a lot of research, Dr. Harriet Washington, who wrote the book Medical Apartheid. We're also going to hear from the great Dr. Khalid Abdul-Muhammad. We will hear a clip from Dr. Michelle Alexander, as well as a clip from Dr. Joy LeGroux. In this broadcast tonight, we're going to tie in the medical, political, the legal, as well as the psychological attacks that we are going through as a people, and get down to what's really going on, which is warfare, and how we're getting hit on all angles. But the thing is, we have great minds, and we have had great minds that have bought us information that are no longer with us, and we have great minds that are still here with us. Everything we need to address what's going on with our people, we have within our own community. So with that being said, let's get tonight's program going. We're going to start with Dr. Harriet Washington. From there, as I mentioned, Dr. Khalid, Michelle Alexander, Dr. Joy LeGroux. Powerful lineup. Let's get this deal started. Black power.
It's black bodies. They took unusual black bodies, and they displayed them in a propagandized context. So if you took a very short man and you surgically implanted horns in his head, and you told him not to speak, and you gave him a manufactured identity, he would appear in the circus. Circuses were run by physicians sometimes. He would appear in the circus and be described as not someone who I own, who I made to do this, but this is a typical inhabitant of an obscure African land. Many of them can't speak. And there was also a very strong tendency to look at Africans of short stature and compare them to animals, to apes. On the right, the man standing there with the monkey grasping his knees is named Otobenga, and he was displayed in the Bronx Zoo in New York City in 1909. Not in 1600, not the 1700s, it was just a century or so ago. Displayed in the Bronx Zoo, at that time, Darwin's theory of evolution was still being hotly contested, and he was displayed as a very powerful, popular argument that here are people who represent the boundary between man and animal. He was put in the zoo with an orangutan in the cage. His cage was littered with bones. And so people who might not read Darwin, who might not be scientifically literate, people who are just sort of, you know, common and interested in popular things, they could be convinced by this. Without picking up Darwin, they could be convinced by this. So this was a very, very important underpinning and part of research with African Americans. The most disturbing and ugly side of study of African American body came from anatomical dissection. And interestingly, it happened very all through the country, mostly in the South at the beginning, but then it spread. And what would happen is that during the 18th and 19th centuries, people felt differently about dead bodies than we do today. People usually died at home, and the body was cared for in a way that was very ritualistic and bound the person to his family and society. You would bathe the body, you dress them in special clothes, you take photographs that you pass around to your family and friends. It was very important to have this bonding ritual. And for that reason, doctors weren't allowed to dissect bodies. The only bodies doctors could dissect were the bodies of criminals, especially heinous criminals, who died under a double sentence of execution and dissection. So that left doctors in a dilemma. Medicine was beginning to evolve, and the Paris School, or the idea that doctors should be familiar with the body, was evolving. They needed bodies to study, and yet the law wouldn't give them any. So where did they turn? They turned to black cemeteries. They turned to black hospitals. They turned to charity wards filled with black patients. And a lot of black people believe they also turned to the streets. I have talked to more Baltimoreans than I would care to tell you who have explained to me that within recent memory, you didn't walk around Johns Hopkins late at night. Now, I'm going to confess to you that the first time I heard that, I thought, I'm not sure I buy that one. But I had to listen when I heard it from one young man who was very fervent about it. And when I talked to him a bit longer, I found out that he was the son of Henrietta Lacks. Henrietta Lacks was a young black woman who in 1951 died, but not before scientists at Johns Hopkins took samples of her cell without her husband's permission. And these cell samples allowed them to found the line of cell line culture. Because of her cell's polio, there was a cure found for polio within a year. Because of her cells, there have been countless medical innovations, new medications tested and inscribed. Her cells have been probably more valuable to American medicine than the contribution of any other person, and yet many people don't even know who she is. So when her son told me that, of course, I had to respect it and pay attention. And although usually, in fact, almost always, people will disparage accounts of, you know, there being night doctors who actually took people and killed them and used their bodies, I did turn up one fully documented case of a Baltimore woman who was indeed killed for her body, and her body was then sold to anatomists. That's such a common thing, by the way. It's not that it's a rare occurrence. It's such a common thing that there's even a name for it. It's called Birking. It's called Birking after the criminal who in England did so many of them that he was eventually caught and hanged for it. So this woman was a white woman, but she lived among black people and had a black boyfriend. And she was killed, and her body was sold to the anatomy department. So there's no evidence of anybody else, but if you think about it, it just might reflect the social realities of Baltimore during that time. What we do know for sure is that the bodies of black criminals, but not white criminals, were likely to be given to anatomists. We do know for sure that doctors, as part of their training, sort of a rite of passage, had to learn to go to cemeteries and exhume bodies. Later, they became more specialized, and the procurement of bodies was left to porters, the people who were bought by hospitals to clean the floors. And they shared this duty. Their job was to go to the black cemetery and exhume bodies. Grandison Harris is probably the best known one. He was a porter at the Medical College of Georgia. And that was his job. We know this because in 1995, construction workers who were renovating the Medical College of Georgia's old laboratory, when they broke into the basement, they found almost 10,000 human bones. 75% of them were for African Americans. People in the Augusta, Georgia area, black people had been complaining for centuries that doctors were taking bodies from the black cemetery. And now, in 1995, it couldn't be denied any longer. And what happened to the Medical College of Georgia actually played out across the country. Most hospitals who had access to a black cemetery were getting their bodies there. And this actually is very well documented in the book. It's not anything that's actually contested. Part of the reason it's not contested is that the physicians themselves were very open about it. If you look at the books in which they write the provenance of the bodies, they were careful to say, we got them from the black cemetery, because they didn't want white people afraid of them, and they didn't want white people rebelling. Also, there was the first black professor of anatomy, Montague Cobb, made a study of it in the Cleveland area, where he found out that at the beginning they had used white bodies, but over time, Cleveland, Ohio, medical schools were using black bodies from the South. So there was a real commerce in shipping black bodies north, often in barrels that were labeled turpentine. And it's, you know, just a horrible thing, but this was real commerce. One other thing I want to point out before I leave this rather gruesome subject is that the image in the center is that of a lynched man. When I look at lynched bodies, I'm often reminded of the bodies such as those on the left, which are hard to see, I think, in this image. I'm sorry, but they're cadavers lying on tables. These are black cadavers lying on tables at the Medical College of Georgia. And what's interesting is that if you look at the men in the anatomical dissection photograph, they're looking right at the camera. They're well-dressed. They're wearing ties and shirts and vests. This is because these photographs were sort of a class portrait, sort of a rite of passage for medical students. When you look at the photos of lynching scenes, you see the same thing. You see well-dressed white people looking very unselfconsciously at the camera, sometimes very jubilantly, and the bodies were disposed of similarly. Medical students would take souvenirs from the bodies. They take pieces of...
Children sometimes seroconvert. They can be born HIV positive. But then if they're fortunate, they will seroconvert, become HIV negative.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, now we know something else we didn't know then, that if you give mothers doses of the proper antiretroviral regimen, then that will increase the chance of her child seroconverting.
Right.
Okay, but we didn't know that then. So although researchers didn't know it at the time, some of these children not only were only HIV positive, but were going to seroconvert
mm-hmm.
and then become HIV negative.
Right.
In which case, the huge doses of medications meant for adults they were given becomes, you know, doubly troubling.
Are they still doing that at that point?
Oh, no. That research has ended.
Okay.
And the Vera Institute of Justice, an independent legal authority, did an investigation, you know, and they did criticize aspects of the study.
You chronicle really an amazing history of experimentation, medical experimentation. The Tuskegee study is the one that most people know about,
right.
You know, involving the black men in Tuskegee who had syphilis, and instead of treating them, you know, the investigator just chronicled the progression of the disease
the public
over
health
time.
Service, yes.
Right. But you also mentioned some others, plutonium and radiation experiments after World War II, where blacks were given, patients were routinely given phenomenally higher doses of X-rays than other people. And in the 1950s, when the Army and the CIA released 4 million mosquitoes per day in Florida near a black housing development, what were they testing? What were they trying to test?
Well, they were trying to test whether transmitting certain ailments by mosquito might be an effective way
mm-hmm.
of performing bioterrorism abroad. If they were actually, for example, just to give an example, if they were going to have conflict with Japan, for example, would it make sense to release mosquitoes in an area of Japan in hopes that they would transmit whooping cough and other ailments?
Right.
So they did it with Americans. They actually transmitted pathogen-borne, you know, agents like mosquitoes, and then they carefully calibrated the cases of whooping cough in the area to see whether they rose, and indeed they did.
Wow. And, you know, a long history of medical experimentation on prison inmates
yes.
who tend to be very disproportionately black. What has been, I mean, the medical establishment's position on these kinds of experiments? I mean, you know, from the AMA or the, well, I can imagine what the NMA had to say about them, but, you know, how about groups like the American Medical Association?
Well, the AMA, you know, didn't take any formal stance on this that I know of, but individuals I know at the AMA have been largely supportive. As a matter of fact, I worked with the AMA this summer in writing a history of the relationship between African American and black physicians. And I got to meet some people in the ethics division of the AMA, and I found them to be very sensitive and very concerned to this history.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was very happy that far from wanting to sweep anything under the rug, they seem eager to have this aired. I think they understand and agree with me that it's important to bring these horrible events to the surface,
mm-hmm.
discuss them, air them, and essentially acknowledge them, because otherwise, how can we move forward and ask black people to participate in medical research?
And then still another area of abuse, I think one could call it, was the forcible sterilization of poor women, including many African-American women, that started, I guess, back in the 30s? Far?
It began before that.
Really?
You know, I think a lot of people don't realize that the eugenics movement that we credit Nazi Germany with
right.
is something that actually began in this country. By 1910, 1915...
Which is basically, let's try not to get the degenerate groups, the lesser groups that we don't want to propagate, let's try not to get them to reproduce. Right.
Right. That was called negative eugenics. You know, you take people who you decide are not worthy of reproducing, and you keep them from reproducing, and there, and that thereby you believe that you can improve the gene pool, therefore improving both the health and the social conditions. It's nonsense, of course, but it's a myth that many scientists clung to. And in this country, it was largely pockets of poor women, but also it was racially driven. There were huge numbers of African-American women who were sterilized without their knowledge or consent. And it didn't, although the popular term for it is Mississippi appendectomy, because
right.
often the women were told you're going to have an appendectomy or your gallstone removal or some kind of innocuous abdominal surgery. And then while they were under, the surgeon would remove their uterus, remove their ovary. So, but it also happened on the West Coast. It happened in Boston. It happened here in New York City.
Right.
It was very prevalent, and there were huge numbers of black women had their fertility stolen.
What kinds of precautionary steps do you feel still need to be taken to make sure that these kinds of abuses are not repeated today?
The first thing that we have to do is roll back this erosion of informed consent. We've got to make sure informed consent is not taken off the table. People have a right to say yes or no to medical research. If you take that from people, you can never expect them to trust the system. That's the first thing that has to be done. And then the other thing we have to do is we have a different type of a double standard, in which we have one standard for medical research protections in this country, but another for the third world. Poor developing countries are bearing the brunt of this history is being repeated in poor developing countries, where abusive research that's devoid of informed consent is being carried on routinely by American and European researchers. So we have to do that. We can't maintain moral credibility without it.
Mm-hmm.
Also, in my opinion, right now things are set up so that there is an IRB, Institutional Review Board, that is supposed to scrutinize and then approve only that research which is ethical and logical and safe. But IRBs have not, the 5,000 IRBs in the country, they haven't been doing a very good job.
Mm-hmm.
They've been letting too many poor research protocols go through. Right now, they're only required to have one person on the IRB that's not affiliated with the institution. And that's a mistake, because that means that the everyday people, the lay people, who are being asked to participate have no voice. They have no power in approving or unapproving studies. So I think that these boards should be composed of half researchers and half lay people.
Okay.
And there have been some researchers who predictably immediately said that
lying on tables at the Medical College of Georgia. And what's interesting is that if you look at the men in the anatomical dissection photograph, they're looking right at the camera. They're well-dressed. They're wearing ties and shirts and vests. This is because these photographs were sort of a class portrait, sort of a rite of passage for medical students. When you look at the photos of lynching scenes, you see the same thing. You see well-dressed white people looking very unselfconscious.
You, I fight myself, I fight God to tell me how many burdens left. I fight pain and hurricanes, today I wept. I'm trying to fight back tears, flood on my doorstep. Life to live in hell, puddles of blood in the street, shooters on top of the building, government aid ain't relief. Earthquake, the body drop, the ground breaks, the poor run with smoke lungs and scarred face. Who need a hero?
Hero.
You need a hero, look in the mirror, there go your hero. Who on the front lines at ground zero?
Hero.
My heart don't skip a beat even when hard times bumps the needle. Mass destruction and mass corruption, the souls of suffering men clutching on deaf ears again, rapture's coming. It's all prophecy, and if I gotta be sacrificed for the greater good, then that's what it gotta
you
be.
Pray to me. Take my pain to me.
About black people that they didn't apply to people of other races. Collectively, that set of beliefs is called scientific racism. But if you have to remember that at the time, from the 17th century through roughly half of the 19th century, and some would argue to the present day, scientific racism was not just a theory, it was science. This is what most scientists believe. Most scientists who dealt with black people believed, and most scientists who dealt with black people were living in the South, because 90% of black people lived in the South up until redistribution. So I think we have to look at the very beginnings of research with black people to understand what's transpiring now. I'm not going to point out each one of these gentlemen, but I am going to say that each of these people are researchers, very famous, very successful American researchers, and most of them have sterling reputations. The gentleman on the upper left-hand corner from the University of Cincinnati is generally credited with perfecting total body irradiation, a technique for treating some types of cancers. The man in the middle, James Marion Sims, is revered as the American father of gynecology. And the guy up in the upper right-hand corner, Surgeon General Thomas Perrin, is credited with the eradication of syphilis. All of these men have wonderful reputations, and every one of them abused and mutilated black people in order to achieve these reputations. Now, I think this is a very important point. James Marion Sims, these are the covers of two books, and on each cover there's a painting of him ministering to slave women, but he had bought these women, and he repeatedly did very intimate, distressing gynecological surgeries with them, repeatedly making incisions in their vaginas and sewing them back up. He was trying to cure a condition called vesico-vaginal fistula, and this made his international reputation. Now, if you notice, these two book covers have the same image. One of them was given permission to use it in 87, and the one on the right was given permission to use it last year. When I asked the owner of the painter to use it for the cover of my book, they said no. And this is a really good example of the type of censorship that has been involved in getting the material for this book. Frequently, I've been denied access to information, and frankly, if Harvard Medical School had not been kind enough to extend my fellowship another year so that as technically being a fellow of the school, I would have access to material I would have been barred from. A lot of the material in this book wouldn't be there. Only because I was able to call people and say, not that I'm a journalist, but I'm a fellow at Harvard Medical School, was I allowed access to some libraries and some collections. So there's a lot of censorship going on. James Marion Sims abused black patients, not just the women in this painting, who one of them had surgeries, 30 surgeries over 5 years. Only half of them were ever cured. But when he devised his technique, he went north, and he went to New York, became the president of the American Medical Association, also head of the New York Academy of Medicine. He went to France, where he attended Princess Eugenie, and became, you know, internationally known as this wonderful gynecologist. But here, back here in the States, he had also, with a slave named Sam, He had a tumor in his jaw. And when he first went, his master first found out, he said, well, he's black. He's got a tumor in his jaw. He must have syphilis. And as is typical in the antebellum period, the master did not call in a doctor. The master treated Sam himself. Unfortunately, this treatment, instead of curing him, made Sam much worse. In addition to a very painful jaw, Sam now had a huge tumor inside his mouth, and he could no longer eat. Sam was one of the best laborers on the farm, and his master wanted to return him productive labor. And he told Sam, I'm sending you to James Marion Sims, a famous surgeon. He'll cure you. Sam said no. He said, I don't want to do it. It'll be too painful. And this is very typical. That's all we know of what Sam had to say, that Sam repeatedly and loudly said, I don't want this surgery. What we don't know is why. Sam might have been afraid of the pain, or he might have gotten wind of Sims' penchant for doing surgery on slave women or other things he had done. We don't know that. But in any event, the decision wasn't Sam's. It was his master, so he shipped off. And when he goes to see Dr. Sims, Dr. Sims very kindly asked about his health, invited him into a chair. When Sam sat down, 10 strong men who were physicians ran forward and tied him to the chair. The chair had been fitted surreptitiously with boards underneath, making it easy for them to tie him down. They tied him down, and then 15 interested other people, who we don't know who they were. They might have been other doctors. They might have been curious people. Came in and watched while Dr. James Marion Sims removed Sam's jawbone without anesthesia.
Oh my God.
He wrote it up in the preeminent medical journal of the South, and the journal ran an editorial saying, we are pleased to record this credible achievement of a Southern surgeon. This is what is the medical society decided to record about the surgery. Nothing about Sam's, you know, Sam's being abused. That wasn't the focus. The focus was a surgical technique. The focus was the fact that Sims had done this new surgery. Sims also took cobbler's tools to move the skull bones of young children around. I mean, this sort of torture passed for medicine. And I think it's really important to understand that the roots of black aversion to medicine lie in this horrible history, which has been preserved by oral history, but not necessarily focused on in the medical journals. The other thing about antebellum research that's really important to understand is that it was profitable. Economics was a very important part of it. We had scientific racism, which not only provided the underpinnings, the permission to do abusive research on slaves, but also provided a rational underpinning for slavery. Because in black people, you had people who could work for a long time in hot sun and not faint. You had people who were immune to malaria, so they said. You had people who were so profligate in their sexuality they couldn't be restrained and constantly bred all the time, which means you had lots of new slaves that you didn't have to pay for. So all the tenets of the scientific racism not only supported medical research, but they supported the slave system, which benefited the South and also benefited the North, which indirectly benefited from the free labor of slavery. So I think a lot of this discourse is left out of discussions of early medical history of blacks. I think all of it is very pertinent. So the one thing that's really, really important and cause a misunderstanding, I think, is the idea of fitness versus health. They're not the same thing. One argument one often hears is that, of course, early physicians and owners did not abuse blacks. Why would they do that? Because they wanted to keep them healthy. They wanted them to work in the fields. You don't want sick blacks, you know, who are unable to work. So, of course, we invested very heavily in their health. No. What was invested heavily in was their ability to produce work, their ability to produce children, which is new slaves, not their health. These are two different things. Many of the sicknesses that slaves suffered from were compatible with working hard, and many of them emanated from the heavy workloads. So with, you know, fitness rather than health as their concern, you saw things like slaves not being immunized for smallpox, as whites were. Why? Because it might leave marks on their bodies that discourage buyers. So it was fitness, not health, that was important. Slaves who were mentally ill, slaves who were chronically underfed and malnourished, slaves who suffered from diseases like malaria that kept them not quite sick, but not quite well. All these things were perfectly compatible with working hard. So that it was not a concern with health, but rather a concern with fitness. In fact, doctors in the South made most of their money in certifying slave fitness, not caring for slaves. This means that if you had a slave for sale and you sold him, and the new owner found that this slave had an illness such as syphilis that made him unable to work, you would go to court. Doctors were paid a large amount of money to testify to slave fitness. He might earn a dollar for treating a slave, but he would earn $50 for testifying in court. So again, profit is a, you know, really important motive in this early experimental abuse of slaves. And these I'm going to go through really quickly. They're probably concepts people are familiar with already, and that is that there was a very large fascination with the black body. And two very disparate things are being said about the black body. On the one hand, in the words of one doctor, McKnight, who said that the body of the Negro is a mass of imperfections from the head to the toe. But at the same time, the same body could work really hard, didn't get sick the way white people did, and could produce more children. So you've got this illogic here, but it's an illogic that's profitable. Black people were also felt to be evolutionary laggards, by which I meant that they hadn't kept up with whites. In fact, many of the so-called experts in black people during this time, people like Dr. Samuel Cartwright, people like Dr. Josiah Nott, were convinced that black people were not fully human. They were considered more closer to the apes than to humans. And this also drove, this also provided more of a moral underpinning for slavery. It's not morally wrong to enslave someone. In fact, there were physicians who said things like, well, people are saying that slavery is inhumane, and we thought about bringing some orangutans from Africa, but the abolitionists would probably tell us that, you know, we had to free them too. I mean, these kind of statements by physicians in a medical context provided a really clear understanding of where they felt blacks fell on the evolutionary ladder. Medicalized display of black people's bodies was very, very important, and I think this is something that's not well understood. There have been people who have said to me, why do you devote so much space to this, because it's not really research, biomedical research in the classic way people think of it. But it was very important because this kind of display drove biomedical research and was indeed part of it. When physicians displayed black bodies, they took unusual black bodies, and they displayed them in a propagandized context. So if you took a very short man and you surgically implanted horns in his head, and you told him not to speak, and you gave him a manufactured identity, he would appear in the circus. Circuses were run by physicians sometimes. He would appear in the circus and be described as not someone who I own, who I made to do this, but this is a typical inhabitant of an obscure African land. Many of them can't speak. And there was also a very strong tendency to look at Africans of short stature and compare them to animals, to apes. On the right, the man standing there with the monkey grasping his knees is named Otabenga, and he was displayed in the Bronx Zoo in New York City in 1909. not in 1600, not the 1700s, it was just a century or so ago, displayed in the Bronx Zoo. At that time, Darwin's theory of evolution was still being hotly contested. And he was displayed as a very powerful, popular argument that here are people who represent the boundary between man and animal. He was put in the zoo with an orangutan in the cage. His cage was littered with bones. And so people who might not read Darwin, who might not be scientifically literate, people who are just sort of, you know, common and interested in popular things, they could be convinced by this. Without picking up Darwin, they could be convinced by this. So this was a very, very important underpinning and part of research with African Americans. The most disturbing and ugly side of study of African American body came from anatomical dissection. And interestingly, it happened very all through the country, mostly in the South at the beginning, but then it spread. And what would happen is that during the 18th and 19th centuries, people felt differently about dead bodies than we do today. People usually died at home, and the body was cared for in a way that was very ritualistic and bound the person to his family and society. You would bathe the body, you dress them in special clothes, you take photographs that you pass around to your family and friends. It was very important to have this bonding ritual. And for that reason, doctors weren't allowed to dissect bodies. The only bodies doctors could dissect were the bodies of criminals, especially heinous criminals, who died under a double sentence of execution and dissection. So that left doctors in a dilemma. Medicine was beginning to evolve, and the Paris school, or the idea that doctors should be familiar with the body, was evolving. They needed bodies to study, and yet the law wouldn't give them any. So where did they turn? They turned to black cemeteries. They turned to black hospitals. They turned to charity wards filled with black patients. And a lot of black people believe they also turned to the streets. I have talked to more Baltimoreans than I would care to tell you who have explained to me that within recent memory, you didn't walk around Johns Hopkins late at night. Now, I'm going to confess to you that the first time I heard that, I thought, I'm not sure I buy that one. But I had to listen when I heard it from one young man who was very fervent about it. And when I talked to him a bit longer, I found out that he was the son of Henrietta Lacks. Henrietta Lacks was a young black woman who in 1951 died, but not before scientists at Johns Hopkins took samples of her cell. Without her husband's permission. And these cell samples allowed them to found the line of cell line culture. Because of her cells, polio, there was a cure found for polio within a year. Because of her cells, there have been countless medical innovations, new medications tested and inscribed. Her cells have been probably more valuable to American medicine than the contribution of any other person. And yet, many people don't even know who she is. So when her son told me that, of course, I had to respect it and pay attention. And although usually, in fact, almost always, people will disparage accounts of, you know, there being night doctors who actually took people and killed them and used their bodies, I did turn up one case, one fully documented case, of a Baltimore woman who was indeed killed for her body, and her body was then sold to anatomists. That's such a common thing, by the way. It's not that it's a rare occurrence. It's such a common thing that there's even a name for it. It's called Birking. It's called Birking after the criminal who in England did so many of them that he was eventually caught and hanged for it. So this woman was a white woman, but she lived among black people and had a black boyfriend. And she was killed, and her body was sold to the anatomy department. So there's no evidence of anybody else, but if you think about it, it just might reflect the social realities of Baltimore during that time. What we do know for sure is that the bodies of black criminals, but not white criminals, were likely to be given to anatomists. We do know for sure that doctors, as part of their training, sort of a rite of passage, had to learn to go to cemeteries and exhume bodies. later, they became more specialized, and the procurement of bodies was left to porters, the people who were bought by hospitals to clean the floors. And they shared this duty. Their job was to go to the black cemetery and exhume bodies. Grandison Harris is probably the best known one. He was a porter at the Medical College of Georgia. And that was his job. We know this because in 1995, construction workers who were renovating the Medical College of Georgia's old laboratory, when they broke into the basement, they found almost 10,000 human bones. 75% of them were for African Americans. People in the Augusta, Georgia area, black people had been complaining for centuries that doctors were taking bodies from the black cemetery. And now, in 1995, it couldn't be denied any longer. And what happened to the Medical College of Georgia actually played out across the country. Most hospitals who had access to a black cemetery were getting their bodies there. And this actually is very well documented in the book. It's not anything that's actually contested. Part of the reason it's not contested is that the physicians themselves were very open about it. If you look at the books in which they write the provenance of the bodies, they were careful to say, we got them from the black cemetery, because they didn't want white people afraid of them, and they didn't want white people rebelling. Also, there was the first black professor of anatomy, Montague Cobb, made a study of it in the Cleveland area, where he found out that at the beginning they had used white bodies, but over time, Cleveland, Ohio, medical schools were using black bodies from the south. So there was a real commerce in shipping black bodies north, often in barrels that were labeled turpentine. And it's, you know, just a horrible thing, but this was real commerce. One other thing I wanted to point out before I leave this rather gruesome subject is that the image in the center is that of a lynched man. When I look at lynched bodies, I'm often reminded of the bodies such as those on the left, which are hard to see, I think, in this image. I'm sorry, but they're cadavers lying on tables. These are black cadavers lying on tables at the Medical College of Georgia. And what's interesting is that if you look at the men in the anatomical dissection photograph, they're looking right at the camera. They're well-dressed. They're wearing ties and shirts and vests. This is because these photographs were sort of a class portrait, sort of a rite of passage for medical students. When you look at the photos of lynching scenes, you see the same thing. You see well-dressed white people looking very unselfconsciously at the camera, sometimes very jubilantly, and the bodies were disposed of similarly. Medical students would take souvenirs from the bodies. They take pieces of skin. They take organs. That's what happened to lynch bodies as well. Bits of skin, organs, hair could be bought and sold in general stores in the areas where people were lynched. There's a very striking resemblance. I'm not entirely sure what it means, except that when black people saw black bodies on dissection tables, I think it stirred up some very powerful emotions, quite aside from the idea of bodies being stolen. Through all the incidents of racial research I found, there's certain, in fact, there are quite a few themes, but some of the more important ones are, just as in the antebellum period, the same thing happens today. There are economic advantages to these biological beliefs about blacks. There's also perversion of science to serve non-scientific ends. What this means is that you have these beliefs about black people which are not logical. You can't both say that they're imperfect and that they're more hardy and stronger than whites. But what happens is white people would subscribe to whatever belief would enable them to do what they wanted to do at that period. And display is a form of abusive research. As I have found out about some of these researches, I've sometimes been challenged when I called them secret, because people will say, well, how can you say it's secret if you said you read it in a medical journal? And I want them to consider the definition of what a secret is. Marcel Pagnol pointed out that a secret is not something unrevealed, but told privately in a whisper. And that's exactly what happened. Everyday people didn't know about this. Black people didn't know about this. But anyone who could read a medical journal would know about this. But who read medical journals? You had to be, first of all, literate in English. And as we know, black literacy has been very vigorously suppressed during most of our history. You had to be able to find the journal. Even today, go to a medical school and try to walk into the library. You know, you may not get in. Medical libraries very strictly control who has access to them. And then, should you find a research journal and read it, even if you yourself are college educated, very literate, it's jargon, it's impenetrable. Very intelligent, very well-educated people will read a medical journal and have no idea what they're reading. But other physicians know, other researchers know. And also the accounts are bulletinized, by which I mean one, the researcher who wrote in the journal didn't tell everything. He didn't tell the things that put him in a bad light. He might have talked about technical aspects of the research. He might have talked about the advances he made. He didn't have to say that he was working on a slave person because, frankly, in certain periods, that was assumed. Another really important question in doing this sort of research is, I'm often asked, well, how can you judge people who acted in the past on the basis of our morals today? We're so much more advanced today. We have a moral framework, ethical framework, we have laws. These things could never happen today, and we can't judge the people back then because they were only doing the best they knew. Well, not really, because the historical facts don't bear this out. You know, there were rules. They weren't government rules, but there were rules by medical societies and by, you know, just medical fraternities about what you did and didn't do to your patients, except in the case of blacks. And then they were routinely flouted. And then, too, physicians and some whites, you know, avoided and opposed racially exploitative research. And when you saw white physicians who did object to it and abolitionists who did object to it, that tells you that it was not commonly accepted mode of behavior. Okay, I'm actually going to not spend much time on these because these are the various modern codes. And what's really important about them is here we begin to see codified in language, here is what you can and can't do to patients and subjects. But the problem is, even though they spelled it out very clearly, there's a belief among American medical researchers that they only apply to Nazi barbarians, you know, other people, not to us. We don't need anyone, you know, watching over our shoulders. We can police ourselves. Even though my book has only one chapter dealing with syphilis experiment, I do want to talk about it briefly because it was really important. It is an iconic experiment. And this quote, I think, is really important because when I looked at the documents, the original documents from the experiment, it's fascinating. The researchers were very, very honest about what it is they sought to do. They sought to deceive 399 black men who had syphilis into thinking they were being treated when they weren't. When you see quotes like this, it sort of shines a light into their mindset. The future of the Negro lies more in the research laboratory than in the schools. When diseased, he should be registered and forced to take treatment before he offers his diseased mind and body on the altar of academic and professional education. Thomas Morell, U.S. Public Health Service. They deceived these men. They lied to them, told them they were being treated when they weren't. And what they wanted to do was simply watch the progress of the disease. They did not want to treat them. They wanted to document the devastation of syphilis, and what they most wanted to do was to validate their belief, the Public Health Service belief, that syphilis manifested differently in blacks and whites. They believed that syphilis ravaged the nervous systems of whites, the brain, the sight, but that it spared the brains of blacks because blacks' brains were undeveloped, primitive. Instead, it only attacked the heart and muscles. And indeed, the researchers did write this up in a study. But when cardiologists looked at the study, they said, it's ridiculous. This is not proven by the study. This is illogical. This is not scientific. So I find this interesting. It illustrates both the cruel scientific racism and the logical blindness of these scientists. One thing that has never been written about before that I address in the book is how the study ended. An ad hoc committee was appointed, and it had some of the best minds of American politics, medicine, and ethics. Two of the really important pivotal people on this ad hoc committee were Ron Brown, who went on to become the U.S. Secretary of Commerce, and Jay Katz, who is at Yale University, a psychiatrist who works in the law school. But the committee was given charges that were way too narrow. They were not given all the information. In fact, the committee never understood that the men didn't know they were in a research study. The committee thought the men had been told this, so they focused on, well, was the study really ethical? Their focus should have been, was lying to these men ethical? Not just was withholding treatment. There was no historian on the committee, and the study lasted for 40 years, from 1932 to 1972. So not having a historian was a very huge omission. Also, very unfortunately, shockingly actually, the members destroyed key evidence. The members of the ad hoc committee decided, after going and getting a collection of oral histories from everyone in the study, researchers, nurses, everybody, they decided to burn it, burn the tape. And the rationale given was that Eunice Rivers, the nurse associated with the study, they were afraid that they were going to, the document would be used to bring her to trial. And they felt, you know, she was an innocent victim, she had been duped, and for that reason they burned the tape. But if you think about that, that's not really logical. Because if they wanted to protect her, the best thing to do was to keep the tape, which gave the account in her own voice. So by burning the tape, they robbed her of her voice. Why didn't they make the tape under seal? They would have done the same thing, protecting her by putting the tape under seal. No one can hear it for 50 years. When she's dead, then you see it. They destroyed the evidence. So this was just a horrible, horrible event that has gotten almost no attention. The myths around the Tuskegee study, I think, are very illuminating. One of them, in fact, the most prevalent, I think, is that the men were injected with syphilis. The men were not injected with syphilis partly because there was no need to. There were enough syphilitic black men in the area. And because researchers were so frank about the horrible things they did in their notes, I think they would have admitted it had they injected the men. But often, when you hear this fear voice, and then you hear someone say, oh, that didn't happen at all, that's just your imagination, you're just being paranoid, it didn't come from paranoia. The congressional record actually indicated that the men had been injected with syphilis. So this myth actually came from the researchers in the study. It didn't come from black people. There's also a belief that the Tuskegee Airmen had been experimental victims. That one took me a while to really try to understand. I thought, One person pointed out to me that Lawrence Fishburne played both one of the Tuskegee Airmen and a subject in Miss Evers' voice. So maybe that helped to perpetuate the myth. But I really think that it's sort of, I think the belief in that myth comes from a sad acknowledgement that Tuskegee University was also a victim of this study. Tuskegee University was the Harvard, you know, the black Harvard. And there were so many wonderful things that happened at that university, so many wonderful scientists that came out of it, and yet, what do we remember it for? An abusive study. How am I doing on time? Okay. One really important aspect of research with black people is that it often results in forbidden knowledge. By that I mean research that's conducted that results in knowledge about black people that's beneficial to black people or to their image tends to be suppressed. For example, pellagra, a disease of the South, syphilis, cholera, and to some extent sickle cell were all considered black diseases. And when research showed that they were not, that research was simply ignored. And public health officials and physicians just continued behaving as if they were black racial diseases. The census of 1840 was very interesting. It helped perpetuate slavery for a while because this census indicated that free blacks were sicker, including much more mentally ill, than enslaved blacks. And so they said it's a powerful argument for slavery. Blacks need to be enslaved. They can't care for themselves. Well, a black physician, Dr. James McCune Smith, one of my personal heroes, and a white physician, Edward Jarvis, refuted this roundly, but the refutation was ignored. And the census data was cited for decades afterwards as if it were accurate. Also, blacks have indeed been responsible for a lot of medical research. But we tend to ignore the research they've done. Onesimus was a slave who actually developed smallpox inoculation. But we never hear his name, and it's always attributed to doctors in who were working in Boston, whom he taught. And black complicity. It's important not just for the Tuskegee study, but for other research. There's a lot of focus on blacks who supposedly have participated in abusive research. Sometimes they did, but their role has always been exaggerated. Look at the picture on the right. These are scientists affiliated with the Tuskegee study. What do you see there? You see two black scientists, right? Wrong. The man standing there had nothing to do with the study. I don't know why he was included in the photograph. The woman on the left is Eunice Rivers, a public health nurse, a black public health nurse, arguably at the bottom of the medical rung. No power, no agency, no autonomy. And yet, if you think of the study, who can tell me the name of someone affiliated with the study? One of the medical care providers. Besides Eunice Rivers? We don't know. You know, only Eunice Rivers. Only her name has survived. O.C. Wenger, Raymond Vandelier, Thomas Morell, Thomas Perrin, these are the men who devised and perpetrated, these are the architects of the study, but their names are not known, only Eunice Rivers.
Here we are. Here we are. Here's for the people.
Egyptian mummies on a flag of a moon, and can't find food for the starving tummies. Pay no mind to the youth, cause it's not like the future depends on it. But save the animals in the zoo, cause the chimpanzee them a make big money. This is how the media pillages, on TV the picture is savages and villages, and the scientists still can't explain the pyramids. Evangelists making a living on the videos of ribs of the little kids, stereotyping the image of the images, and this is what the image is. You buy a khaki pants and all of a sudden you are say a Indiana Jones. And I took all the gold and took all the scrolls and even the bird bones. Some of the worst paparazzi I've ever seen and ever known. Put the words on this place that the world can see and it's all that will ever show. So the ones in the west will never move east and feel like it'll be at home. Get tricked by the beast but the way them a go flee when the monster is fully grown. Salamonic lineage where them two can defeat and them could have never clone. A spiritual DNA that prints in my soul and I will forever own, Lord.
Yeah. Sabali, that's patience. That's what the old folks told me. Can you get with that? Discovering the world before this world. A world buried in time. Uncovered with rhyme. It's no realer.
We born not knowing, are we born knowing all? We growing wiser, are we just growing tall? Can you read thoughts? Can you read palms? Can you predict the future? Can you see storms coming? The earth was flat, if you went too far you would fall off. Now the earth is round, if the shape changed again everybody would have thought lost. The average man can't prove of most of the things that he chooses to speak of. And still run research and find out the roots of the truth that you seek of. Scholars teach in universities and claim that they're smart and cunning. Tell them find a cure when we sneeze and that's when their nose start running. And the rich gets fixed up when we get cut. Wanna heal them broken bones in the bush with the wet mud. Can they read signs? Can they read stars?
Can you make peace? Can you fight war? Can you milk cows, even though you drive cars? Can you survive against all odds now?
It's crazy. When you feed people the truth, you don't know how they're gonna react. You're scared of wrongdoers. People that's just ignorant. You're scared of the truth. Be patient. For now. Who wrote the Bible? Who wrote the Quran? And was it a lightning storm that gave birth to the earth and then dinosaurs were born? Who made up words? Who made up numbers? And what kind of spell is mankind under? Everything on the planet we preserve and can it. Microwave it and try it, no matter what, we'll survive it. What's you? What's man? What's human? Anything along the land we consuming. Eating, deleting, ruin. Trying to get paper. Gotta have land, gotta have acres. So I can sit back like Jack Nicholson, watch niggas play the game like the Lakers. In a world full of 52 fakers, gypsies, seances, mystical prayers. You superstitious, throw salt over your shoulders, make a wish for the day, cuz like somebody got a doll of me. Sticking needles in my artery, but I can't feel it. Sometimes it's like part of me, but I got a real big spirit. A fearless. Don't you try to grab hold of my soul. It's like a military soldier since 7 years old. I held real dead bodies in my arms, felt their body turn cold. Oh, why are we born in the first place if this is how we gotta go? Dang. To all the wisdom and knowledge seekers of the world. Savali. Patience.
Yeah. War no more. You can't say that. You say, well, we don't need guns. We need books. Shut up, fool. The white man make all the guns. How we gonna go up against the white man? We can't compete with the white man with all the guns. Well, fool, he make all the books. How you gonna compete with him if he makes all the books? You willing to go that route? I was talking to a young Sunni Muslim brother at Mark 125 yesterday. He said, well, do you really think we still oppressed? In America, I'm not lying, as God is my witness. Young brother, but he still has... a good chance, this young brother. He said, you think we still oppressed? And he went on to show me how things had changed and how we weren't oppressed anymore. He really believed that. And I told him, since I knew he was coming from Islam, I told him that Prophet Muhammad, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, that Prophet Muhammad said, you must stop the oppressor. Stop the hand of the oppressor. Physically stop him. The Holy Quran says, and fight. Fight with those who fight against you. That persecution and bloodshed, that persecution and the murder of your people is worse than bloodshed. The Quran says it's better to go on and fight and shed some blood, but persecution and the shedding of blood and the slaughter of your people, it's not worse than dealing with your enemy and shedding your enemy's blood. Fight. Fight with those who fight against you. It says, and drive them out from where they drove you out. It says, and fight with them until there is no more war. Fight with them until there is no more bloodshed. I told him that Prophet Muhammad, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, says, stop the hand of the oppressor. Physically, fight him. But Prophet Muhammad goes on to say, if you can't fight him physically and stop his hand physically, speak out against him. Strongly speak out against him. And if you can't stop him physically and stop the hand of the oppressor physically, if you can't speak out boldly and strongly against him, Prophet Muhammad says, then secretly protest in your heart. But secret protest in your heart is the poorest and the weakest form of protest, he said. He said, oh, see, I put his man on him. That's the way we got to be. We got to know all of the doctrines, all of the philosophy, all of the ideology, so we can go after our people and bridge the gap and pull them together and form an African United Front or a Black United Front. But we got to know what they know and then some. So when I put Prophet Muhammad on him and told him that, you know, if you want to secretly protest in your heart, the Nabi or the Prophet said that's the poorest form of protest. Then he's ready to talk. So the day he saw me, I was over there. He was very excited. He wanted another conversation. So I drop a little something else on him, and he's a good little brother coming along. I'm almost there, if you'll give me just a few more minutes. There would be less police brutality if the masses were armed. Mark Furman's would be hard to find. Mark Furman was not an exception to the rule. Mark Furman talked about the brotherhood of policemen, the fraternity of policemen. He said that the policeman is God. That's what he said. There's a devil saying that the policeman is God. He's judge, jury, and executor. Huh? Right on the spot. He talked about how he used to beat black men and women and Chicano brothers and sisters until he would just beat the waste out of them, beat the mess out of them. He said, then you could smell the niggas and the, you could smell the niggas and the Mexicans or the Chicano. You could smell them, you could smell them stinking. He said you couldn't get into the jail for the stench coming from them. They just beat them until they urinate on themselves, beat them until their bowels would waste all over. He said he'd grab them and just throw them down the steps, just throw them down. And another cracker down at the other end of the steps or catch them at the other end of the steps, kick them and beat them. No, you got to, I'm here to tell you that the only way you're going to stop police brutality is you got to stand up and be brutal with this damn beast. You got to step to this cracker or it will never stop. You can moan, you can groan, you can sing, you can pray. You can recite, you can claim you know all the Quran, Old Testament. All the Bible, Old Testament, New Testament, the Quran from Al-Fatiha to Al-Nas. You can know all the Medunete. You can know Maya, truth, justice, righteousness, harmony, balance, order, reciprocity. You can name those of the Netter system. You can go and study the Odu text and substantiate your position according to Odu. You can study the Ifa or the Word or the Akan or the Yoruba and run through the pantheon of the Orisha. You can call on Oludumare. You can call on Ilegba and Shango and Obatula and Oshun and Ogun and Yemonya. You can know all of that. But unless you're willing to stand up and step to this white man, we will never get out of this condition. Frederick Douglass said the limits of a tyrant is prescribed by exactly how far you will let that tyrant go. He won't stop if you don't stop him. It's like any bully. The bully will keep picking on you until you get him to raise up off of you. Some of us will lose our lives. Tupac is gone already. Biggie is gone already. Many of us, Yusuf Hawkins is gone already. Many of us are already dead and we're dying every day. And while we're here in Queens tonight, black men and women and young black boys are dying at the hands of some cracker somewhere in America right now. I would rather die for a cause than to die because you in some barroom pinching somebody's wife on the booty on the bar stool and get your throat cut with a Miller Lite bottle. It's a hell of a life, man. That's a hell of a way to go. Say, your daddy got killed. Say, yeah. How'd he get kissed? He pinched somebody's wife on the booty at the bar stool. The dude picked up a Miller Lite bottle of Budweiser Light and broke it and cut his throat. Is that the way he died? Well, he died in the East Coast, West Coast fight. East Coast? West Coast? You a damn fool. You'll die over some bullshit? Some damn records? A damn CD? You are what you call a recording studio gangster? Oh, you bad as hell in the recording studio. There ain't a nigga in the world better than you. Capone couldn't mess with you. Babyface Nelson. None of them couldn't mess with you. A recording studio gangster. You just as bad as you can be. You gon' blow, put your gat in the nigga's mouth and blow the nigga's brains out. I'll stomp that hoe. I'll kick that bitch. White man show up, you can hear a rat pee on cut. Nigga ain't ready to fight. Nigga ain't ready to fight. I say we must arm the masses. Most of y'all got guns anyway. You shoot them for the 4th of July. Damn day that ain't even your Independence Day. Yes, you do. You shoot them on New Year's and New Year ain't even in yet. You just got them. They're just toys. Or you'll go get them on your wife. Draw the gun on her because she burnt the beans. For the 4th time, she'll just go order some beans. Or she'll draw the pistol on you because the phone rang at 2 in the morning and you stayed on too long, talking too low. Two or three brothers, so bad. I'm Crip. Two or three brothers so bad, I'm blood. They'll go off into territory of their rival brother gang and face bumper jacks, face chains, baseball bats, pipes, nines, AKs, face everything in a fratricidal war with your kith and kin, your flesh and blood, your brother.
The crack cocaine, sweeping inner city communities. No, actually, President Reagan announced his drug war a few years before crack hit the streets. But once it did, the Reagan administration seized on this development with glee, actually hiring staff whose job it was to publicize inner city crack babies, crack dealers, launched a media campaign, to expose, crack in inner city communities in the hopes of building public support for a drug war they had already declared. And the plan worked like a charm. Our television sets were flooded with images of black and brown, drug users and dealers, crack babies, the whole nine. Our television sets were saturated for nearly a decade with these images. And in short order, Democrats began competing with Republicans to show they could even be tougher on crime than them. Could be even tougher. And President Clinton, boasted outside on the campaign trail. He boasted in front of a prison where, a man had just been executed, a mentally impaired African-American man being executed. He flew from the campaign trail to watch the execution and then stood outside the prison saying, I can be nicked a lot, but nobody can say I'm not tough on crime. President Clinton in office, again, attempting to win over those same so-called white swing voters. He championed three strike laws. He presided over the largest increase in African American imprisonment in our nation's history. He and the New Democrats championed legislation barring drug felons from public housing, no matter how minor the offense, denying them from basic public benefits, including food stamps for the rest of their life. Discrimination is now perfectly legal in virtually every aspect of political, economic, and social life once you've been branded a felon. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court has, you know, for the most part, turned a blind eye
right.
to race discrimination in the criminal justice system. Now, people often ask me, you know, if racial bias is as bad as you say it is in the criminal justice system, why don't you file more lawsuits about it, you know? How come we don't hear about people filing lawsuits in the news, you know, challenging the bias of police or prosecutors and, you know, what, if it's so bad, why don't we see more lawsuits about this? But what people don't realize is that the U.S. Supreme Court has made it virtually impossible to file claims of race discrimination in the criminal justice system. As I describe in some detail in Chapter 3, the court has closed the courthouse doors to claims of racial bias at every stage of the criminal justice process, beginning with, you know, stops and searches, to plea bargaining, and sentencing. In a series of cases, you know, beginning with, you know, Armstrong versus the United States, McCleskey versus Kemp, the Supreme Court has made clear that only evidence of conscious, intentional bias, the very sort of bias that's nearly impossible to prove these days in the absence of an admission, is deemed sufficient. Now, of course, most folks, including most law enforcement folks, know better than to say, I stopped him because he was black.
Right.
I didn't give him the good plea deal because he's black. Most people, some don't, but most people have enough sense not to acknowledge their bias openly in the so-called era of color blindness. But the U.S. Supreme Court has insisted on that kind of proof in order to even get in the courthouse doors. The court has, a practical matter, closed the courthouse doors. It said no matter how overwhelming your statistical evidence, no matter how severe the racial disparity, unless you can offer proof of conscious, intentional bias, you do not have a case to make of discrimination in the criminal justice system. And in this way,
you know what I'm talking about. Huh? Don't you? All right. I thought you did. He discovered America with all these people here. When he takes something, when he steals something, when he roughs something, when he robs something, when he bum-rushes somebody's place and just wipes out whatever they got and run off with it, it's called a discovery. When he has a riot, it's called a Boston Tea Party. These Deckerwoods have a straight-out riot in a harbor and tear up a damn ship, and they call it a tea party. Can you imagine? Call it a tea party. Makes no sense at all. When they wipe out the Indians on TV, it's a victory. But if the Indians wipe them out, it's a massacre. I mean, this guy is forever playing word games. He's just the devil. As I said, he's the first friendly action. I have to say it, I know it makes some of you uneasy, but I have to say it just every now and then I have to say it. Because I believe you should remind yourself. Remind yourself to remember, to remember, to remember. Just so you won't forget that the white man is not a devil, but the white man is the devil. You wouldn't be here if some devil hadn't brought you here. Harlem wouldn't be run down if some devil hadn't put us in this condition. Broad Brooklyn, none of it would be run down. Watts in Los Angeles, sections of Detroit, South Side, West Side of Chicago. It wouldn't be run down if some devil hadn't put us in this position. I know some of you love them. Lord have mercy, child. I just love everybody. I don't care what them old
Farrakhan and Elijah Mohammed people say, I just love everybody. Lord have mercy, child. I just can't hate nobody.
That's what we say.
But you hate your black self. If you didn't hate your black self, you wouldn't wear a scary curl. You'd wear it the way God gave it to you. You wear a button saying, I'm nappy, and I'm happy. If you didn't hate yourself, you wouldn't wear blondes. And blondes have more fun. And you ain't having no fun. What Spike Lee calls wannabe. Girl, you know you're a jigaboo. And we love these jigaboos. Don't we love these jigaboos? Because this is God's woman. And when we say jigaboo, we mean you got that strong head. Heck, our women got that good hair. Ain't that right? We got good hair, too. I got some. I had to spend some minutes this morning. I just wear bald. If I let it grow out, I got good hair, too. I mean, it's stand up, too. Top of my head, just like yours. We say we love everybody, but we hate ourselves. Can you imagine a fellow moon walking across the stage and take scissors or something, cut his nose off and try to make his nose pointed like the white man? Have him to break his jaws and try to take the high pointed like the white man? Have him to break his jaws and try to take the high cheekbones out? Take shots and try to take the color out of his skin. Take some hormone shots and try to take the male out of his makeup. White folks just made them a product. Neither black nor white, neither male nor female. Just for everybody. Whatever's your thing, I got it for you. I got a product for you. Should wear a stamp on his head saying, Made in America. And that's the way it was made. That's way it was made. Made in America.
Died of malnutrition and starvation because they could tell by the rotting of the teeth and the jawline. So even though they most likely grew food, they weren't allowed to eat it. And then they found something even more peculiar that speaks to this idea of why he believed we required less sleep. They would show a large frame man, and they would find an injury where the muscle actually detached itself from the bone as a result of exertion and not injury. Stay with me. It detaches itself from the bone as a result of exertion. That means you work so hard, the muscle detached itself from the bone. You don't see those kind of injuries in contemporary society because no one's going to work that hard. Unless, of course, you have a gun trained on you from sunrise to sunset. So we do have empirical evidence of how hard folks worked. Then he went on to say that we were dumb, cowardly, and incapable of feeling grief. Why would Thomas Jefferson need to believe that? Why would he need to believe we didn't feel grief? What was he doing, do you think, that produced cognitive dissonance? You were killing people. Not only were you killing people, beating them, you were selling them, yes? Selling mothers away from their children and husbands away from wives. And surely they don't feel it, because if they felt it, that would make them human like me. So I simply say, and you see, it's not so much, it's not even so much that he said it, but he was an important person. If Joe, nobody said it, but he said it. So what do you think the rest of the folks, uneducated laborers, believed? Well, they don't feel grief, you know. After all, Thomas Jefferson says they don't. So he becomes a critical person in making those statements. But you see, it was all to relieve and to settle the conscience that he died with. But these become very important as you see how these things move forward. Then there was J. Marion Sims. I won't spend a lot of time with him. He's another figure. You can Google him. There's a statue, actually, of him in Central Park. And J. Marion Sims was an individual credited. He was the father of modern gynecology. How many women in here know what a vaginal speculum is? And for those men in the room that we lost, a vaginal speculum is a device designed to open up the vagina. It was considered one of the most important advancements in medicine that was made. He was credited as being the wealthiest physician to have ever lived. And what's interesting about him, you know, look at the medals pinned on him. I was just very curious about how it was they regarded this man, because no one ever really looked at how did he come up with that vaginal speculum. The way he did it was he actually worked on experiments on unanesthetized slave women. He created a makeshift hospital in his backyard in the mid-1800s. He built the first vaginal speculum from a pewter spoon. And he reasoned that slave women were able to bear great pain, meaning we don't need any anesthesia, because their race made them more durable and thus they were well suited for painful medical experimentation. We didn't even, you know, because we didn't feel like other women could feel. This man would cut into women, cut into them, and just said, well, since they're black, they don't really feel it. Unbelievable. And more importantly is what he did to infants, because not only did he experiment on women, he also experimented on infants. He said that black infants suffered from something he called trimus nascentium, which is now commonly referred to as neonatal tetanus. Neonatal tetanus originates in horse manure, which was the likely cause of the disease in slave infants. He attributed it to the indecency and intellectual flaws of slave infants together with skull malformations at birth. That is a shoemaker's awl. And that's the 1800s shoemaker's awl. He would stick that into the heads of brand new infants in an effort to realign their skulls based on the indecency and intellectual flaws of their parents, to treat the malady. Of course, it was 100% death rate. But that's what he would stick in the head of a baby at birth. And so these are things that are so horrific that you can't possibly wrap your head around it. And this man is, I mean, just Google him. And you think to myself, I think to myself, if I were up here in front of you right now, and this is going to become very important as you move, I move into the other slides, if I stomped a puppy to death out here, up here, just a little puppy, and stomped it right here to death in front of you, most of you would need therapy. And I would be arrested probably faster than killing a black man for killing a puppy. How could you do that? Do you realize how much dissonance you have to remove in order to stick that into the brain of a child? More importantly, the child can no longer be human. Are you understanding what I'm saying? The reason why he could do it is they weren't human. They didn't even feel pain. That's what this man believed. Now, you may look at that and go, those are horrific things from the past. There's a book out right now, not table reading. It's called Medical Apartheid. This is written by Harriet Washington, came out last year. This book chronicles the experimentation on black people up to contemporary day. See, we want to look at the Tuskegee experiments. We want to look at Sims and go, oh, that just still going on. Implicated, Harvard, Johns Hopkins, because we weren't what? Human. So that dehumanization is something that we really got to appreciate went on for a long time. Can you go back? Back one more. No white could ever rape a slave woman. The regulations of law as to the white race on the subject of sexual intercourse do not and cannot, for obvious reasons, apply to slaves. Their intercourse is promiscuous. We've now justified raping black women because they can't be raped. We aren't raping them. They're promiscuous by nature. So we can't do it. Forward. One more. The fact that white men could profit from raping their female slaves does not mean that their motive was economic. The rape of slave women by their masters was primarily a weapon of terror that reinforced whites' domination over their human property. Rape was an act of physical violence designed to stifle black women's will to resist and to remind them of their servile status. These become important instruments that you look at. And I want to give you some statistics as it relates to American history. By the mid-1800s, there was over 600,000 mixed-race children born. 600,000. How many of you know what miscegenation is? Miscegenation is an illegal marriage between people of different races. Actually, it was very profound here. That it was illegal to marry someone of another race. So when you consider the fact that one of the greatest issues and one of the number one reasons why black men were lynched, beaten, and imprisoned had to do with the fear that they were going to rape whom? White women. Now the numbers, I mean, we're talking about pure numbers, numbers alone. It was who being raped? Okay, it was black women being raped, but they can be raped. Let's advance forward. Before we get into the Casual Killing Act, the Casual Killing Act was written because of the number of people who were killed while being corrected. Okay. And if any slave resists his master, owner, or other person by his or her order, correcting such slave and shall happen to be killed in such correction, it shall not be counted felony, but the master, owner, and every other person so giving correction shall be acquitted of all punishment and accusation for the same as if such accident had never happened. So that means that if you happen to be correcting someone and you beat them to death, you know how hard it is to beat someone to death? I mean, I thought about that. I said it happened so frequently that they created a law so that you wouldn't feel any what? No guilt, because you were simply correcting them. It wasn't your fault. So I went back to look at who was beating folks to death. I wanted to know. And it was white women. White women were beating black children to death. That's who was being beaten to death. But it wasn't her fault. She was just correcting them. You see, what we do is we rob ourselves of our own humanity when we refuse to look at this stuff. We rob ourselves of our humanity. And that's what people didn't know happened. Going forward, one more. Then you had the mental health folks. This is how we got in. We got in to try to fix it. In the early years of the 19th century, a physician named Samuel A. Cartwright argued that two particular forms of mental illness caused by nerve disorders were prevalent among slaves. One was drapetomania, which was diagnosable by a single symptom, the uncontrollable urge to escape from slavery. So now what we've done is we've now pathologized your desire to be free. Must be something wrong with them. Keep trying to free themselves. And again, it would be funny if it weren't in journals. You see, all of this is to remove the cognitive dissonance. Now we have, look at all the people joining in. You got Linnaeus, you got anthropology, you got physicians. All of them saying, they deserve it. It's not us. We don't need to adjust anything. And if they just tried harder, how about you people just pull yourselves up from your bootstraps? What's the matter with you? The playing field has been leveled. Well, we're going to see if, in fact, it's been leveled. Or is that conjecture? Move forward. Now, I want you to look at this photo very closely, and I want you to see who's in it. More important than the man hanging, because you got to understand the lynchings that occurred in America happened after slavery. Not during. Thousands of lynchings happened after slavery because this is a reaction to white fear of what we would do once freed. But we didn't create a vigilante group to take out white people, but they did create a vigilante group to take us out now that we're free. See, that happened after slavery. They were called the what? The Ku Klux Klan. They don't wear hoods anymore. They wear suits. But they're alive and well all over the world, even here. So look at who's in the picture. I want you to look at this little girl in particular. You can't see her closely, but she's actually grimacing, like smirking. Now, remember, let's go back to the puppy concept here. She would be loathed and torn up probably if this was a puppy, which means he's less than that. Because she's not disturbed. This little girl is not disturbed by this.
We must understand clearly when we talk about capitalism, who are the capitalists? As if we understand that there are only a few people who own and control the means of production in the society, then we begin to understand that there are a few capitalists. And these capitalists exploit everybody because everybody works for them. Everybody sells their labor to them. It is by selling your labor to a capitalist that he's really able to exploit you. Instead of going through theories, let me give some direct example. Let's say that I'm a capitalist. And let's say that I sell shirts. I have a shirt factory. Let's say this is my factory. I own it. The machinery. I have a place where I get cotton. Now, I own it. I'm the capitalist. And let's say you are my workers. You are my workers. You don't know me. You never see me. You see my lackeys, you know, maybe my foreman, but you never see me. Now, let's say it costs me 50 cents for cotton for every shirt I make. And let's say it costs me 50 cents for upkeep of my machinery. That's a dollar. And let's suppose I pay you a dollar for every shirt you make. That means it costs me $2 to get a shirt, labor included, your labor. I pay you for making the shirt. Now, when I sell the shirt, being a capitalist, and you must know something about capitalism, very important. The sole motivating force in a capitalist society is profit. Profit. That is the sole motivating force. Profit. Get money. Get it. Get it as fast as you can. Get it any way you can, but get it. Just get it. Just get it. And even in the African community, it affects us here in this country because Africans, those of us living in America, those of us born in America, we are imbued with the philosophy of capitalism, and sometimes we don't even recognize it. Thus, you find brothers and sisters even selling dope to their brothers and sisters to make money. Again, because we're imbued with the philosophy of get some money. Ain't nothing wrong to kill for money. Hell, your country is napalming for money. You can certainly kill for some money. All right, just get it. Just get it. It's the overall philosophy. When we talk about revolution, we must talk about changing values. We must talk about changing values, and we must understand these values. To the shirt factory. I've not forgotten. I'm just going to tie it in. I'll tie it in for you. I'll tie it in. You will see, you must look under the shirt factory, too. You must look for spiraling economy. That's very important, spiraling economy. I sell the shirt for $5. I sell the shirt for $5. I don't do anything. You're the one who makes the shirt. I'm exploiting your labor. You toil, you sweat, I get the fruit. That's right, I get it. But you grow it, you plant it by the sweat of your brow. I get it. I sell the shirt for $5. I am exploiting your labor. I really am exploiting your labor. I mean, even when you want a shirt, hey, you got to come to my store and buy the shirt for $5. Hey, I really am exploiting you. Now, you're workers, you're in a factory, so you begin to get social consciousness. Yes, you do. Marx talks about this. Because you're working together, you see the socialized process, the laboring process, and you're able to see clearly how you're being exploited. So you get together, and you start talking about, we want more money. So you tell my foreman we want more money. So the foreman comes to see me. He says, the workers say they want more money. Later for them. Keep them working, man. So he comes back, no raise. They all work, but you all get a little bit more agitated, you know, because it's scientific. The pressure rises, and as the pressure rises, the consciousness must rise. It's scientific. It can't be stopped. That's why revolution can't be stopped. Then you say, hey, look here, we're going to strike. So the foreman comes back and says, hey, they say they're going to strike. I say, oh, let them strike, man. And sure enough, y'all strike. Yeah, y'all strike on me. Now, when you strike, of course, my machinery stops. I ain't making no money. So after a while, I called my foreman. I said, what do they want? He says, well, they said they want $1.50 more a shirt. They want 50 cents more a shirt. So I said, okay, let them have it. So I'll bring you back. You happy? I pay you $1.50 more. Right. So it now costs me $2.50 to make a shirt. It costs me $2.50 to make a shirt. Before, it cost me $2. I was selling it for $5. But hey, look here. I can't go out there and keep selling it for $5. Hey, how am I going to do that? I'm going to lose profit. And look here, Since the sole motivating force in a capitalist system is profit, ain't no need for me to come and sell it for $5.50. No. Next time you see that shirt on the market, it's going to cost you $7.50. Right. Right. And that's what's known as the spiraling economy, because profit is what about wages go up into demands of the workers and prices rocket. Wages go up, prices rocket. And it keeps going and going and going until it's got to blow the top. It's scientifically real. That's why Nixon is talking about freezing wages and freezing prices. He's stupid. You got to freeze capitalism, Nixon. Freeze capitalism. That's the problem. That's the problem. Yeah, that's the problem. You must understand these concepts, because once you begin to understand them and master them, you will see the inevitability of revolution. Not only the inevitability of revolution, but you will see the inevitability of victory for the struggling masses around the world once you understand the scientific principles of revolution.
In the 60s, you will see nothing but betrayals by the petty bourgeois elements in our society. The African bourgeoisie is the most corrupt bourgeoisie in the world. In Africa, they seek luxury in the midst of mass suffering. There are more Mercedes in Africa than in any other continent in the world. In America, as soon as they arrive at a position based on the blood of the people, they snatch that position and run away from the people. But you must not think that they represent the people. They only represent their opportunistic self using the people every step of the way. So you must not be confused. It must be clear then, for the 60s, the class struggle in the African Revolution must be more ruthless and uncompromising than in any other revolution. Here then, the masses must come without pity and without mercy to trample upon these reactionary pigs who, after the people have gained struggle through their blood, come to hand back the gains on a silver platter to the very enemy the people fought. This will come as a natural consequence. The people themselves are everywhere screaming that it's time for them to deal with these reactionary pigs. Even in America, they say, our leaders must be held accountable. They're only saying here that these people must be accountable to those who made it possible for them to get there. Thus, not only is the revolution inevitable, but it is clarifying itself and it is qualifying itself. For the African masses everywhere, the clairvoyant position now for class struggle has become inevitable and irreversible. The petty bourgeoisie everywhere will be running for cover, but the masses will spare them not. Consequently, we who have dedicated our lives to the people's struggle, we who, knowing that the people will always be free, we, understanding that we must make a contribution to qualify our struggle since the 60s, have been dedicating all our energies to only one task, the organization of the masses of our people. The organization of the masses of our people. We are not running for mayor. We're not running for president. No changes can come from the top down. We're not stupid. Changes can only come from the bottom up. The masses and the masses alone can make them. If you want to learn something from the 60s, the lesson is simple. Organize the masses of the people. Thank you.
Such as they ensured that the United States would come to its maturity under circumstances, which mean that for a substantial proportion of citizens, life is nothing more than a living bed. Liberty is nothing more than a prison of poverty. And the only happiness we enjoy is laughing to keep from crying. We find evidence for majority freedom and minority oppression in the fact that even while the early settlers were proclaiming their freedom, they were deliberately and systematically depriving Africans of their freedom. These basic contradictions were further aggravated by acts which implicitly admitted that the majority was wrong, but unwilling to do right. Thus, when the Declaration of Independence was drafted, the Founding Fathers struck all mentions of the slave trade. Thus, when the United States Constitution was drafted, the Founding Fathers considered the slaves as equivalent to three-fifths of a man. Thus, when the slaves were emancipated, the descendants of the founding fathers compromised that freedom to gain further territory. These compromises were so basic to the thinking of the forebears that legal attempts to correct the contradiction through constitutional amendments and civil rights laws have produced no change in our conditions, and we are still a people without equal protection and due process of the law. We recognize then that the oppressive acts of the United States government, when contrasted with the testaments of freedom, carries forward a basic contradiction found in all the legal documents upon which this government is based. Generation after generation of the majority group have been born, they have worked, and they have seen the fruits of their labor in the life, liberty, and happiness of their children and grandchildren. Generation after generation of black people in America have been born, they have worked, and they have seen the fruits of their labor in the life, liberty, and happiness of the children and grandchildren of the oppressor. While their own descendants wallow in the mire of poverty and deprivation, holding only to the hope of change in the future. The hope has sustained us for many years and has led us to suffer the administration of a corrupt government. At the dawn of the 20th century, this hope led us to formulate a civil rights movement in the belief that the government would eventually fulfill its promise to black people. We did not recognize, however, that any attempts to complete the promise of the 18th century revolution in the framework of a 20th century government, economy, and society was doomed to failure. The descendants of that small company of original settlers of this land are not among the common people of today. They have become a small ruling class in control of a worldwide economic system. The Constitution set up by their ancestors to serve the people no longer serves the people, for the people have changed. The people of the 18th century have become the ruling circle of the 20th century, and the people of the 20th century are the descendants of the slaves and the dispossessed of the 18th century. The Constitution set up to serve the people of the 18th century now serves the ruling circle of the 20th century. And the people of today stand wanting for a foundation for their own life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. The Civil Rights Movement has not produced this foundation, and it cannot produce this foundation because of the nature of the United States society and economy. The vision of the Civil Rights Movement is to achieve goals which have been altered by 200 years of change. Thus, the Civil Rights Movement and similar movements have produced no foundation for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. They have produced humiliating programs of welfare and unemployment compensation, programs with sufficient form to deceive the people, but with insufficient substance to change the fundamental distribution of power and resources in this country. Moreover, while the movements attempt to get minorities into the system, we note that the government continues this pattern of practice which contradicts its democratic rhetoric. We recognize now that we see history repeating itself, but on an international as well as a national scale. The relentless drive for profit led this nation to colonize, oppress, and exploit its minorities. This profit drive took this nation from democratic capitalism and underdevelopment to bureaucratic capitalism and overdevelopment. Now we see that the small ruling circle continues its profit drive by oppressing and exploiting the people of the world. Throughout the world, the proletariat is crushed so that the profits of the American industry can continue to flow. Throughout the world, the freedom struggle of oppressed people are opposed by this government because they are a threat to the bureaucratic capitalism of the United States of America. We gather here to let it be known at home and abroad that a nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness has in its maturity become an imperialistic power dedicated to death, oppression, and the pursuit of profit. We will not be deceived by so many of our fellow men. We will not be blinded by small changes in form which lack any change in substance of the imperialist expansion. Our suffering has been too long. Our sacrifices have been too great, and our human dignity is too strong for us to be prudent any longer. Panther Party calls for freedom and power to determine our destiny. The Black Panther Party calls for full employment for all our people. The Black Panther Party calls for an end to the capitalistic exploitation of our community. The Black Panther Party calls for decent housing for all people. The Black Panther Party calls for an educational system that will tell us the true facts about this decadent society. The Black Panther Party calls for exemption from the military service. The Black Panther Party calls for an end to police brutality. The Black Panther Party calls for freedom for all political prisoners and prisoners of war. The Black Panther Party calls for trials by members of our peer when we're brought to the court and justice. The Black Panther Party calls for a United Nations plebiscite to determine the will of black people as to their national destiny. Black people and oppressed people in general have lost faith in leaders of America, in the government of America, and the very structure of the American government, that is the Constitution, its legal foundation. This loss of faith is based upon the overwhelming evidence that this government will not live according to the Constitution because the Constitution is not designed for its people. For this reason, we assemble a constitutional convention to consider rational and positive alternatives. Alternatives which will place the emphasis on the common man. Alternatives which will bring about a new economic system in which the rewards as well as the work will be equally shared by all people. A socialist framework. Alternatives which will guarantee that within the socialist framework, all groups will be adequately represented in decision-making and administration which affect their lives. Alternatives which would guarantee that all men will obtain their full manhood rights, that they will be able to live, be free, and seek out those goals which will give them respect and dignity while permitting the same privileges for every other man regardless of his condition or status. The sacredness of man and of the human spirit requires that human dignity and integrity ought to always be respected by every other man. We will sell for nothing less, or at this point in history, anything less is but a living death. It is a fact that we will get change. We will transform the society. It is up to the oppressor to decide whether this will be a peaceful thing or... We will use whatever means that is effective, regardless of the consequence, because it is our conclusion and our principle that a slave who dies a natural death will not balance two dead flies on the scales of eternity. We will have our manhood, even if we have to level the face of the earth in an attempt to get it. So I would like to say that we are one tonight. Let us be one in the future. Power to all of the people.
Here we are. For the people.
helmet. Carry the language of Egyptian mummies on a flag or a moon. And can't find food for the starving tummies. Pay no mind to the youth, cause it's not like the future depends on it. But the animals in the zoo, cause the chimpanzee them a make big money. This is how the media villages on TV the picture is. Savages and villages and the scientists still can't explain the pyramids. Evangelists making a living on the videos of ribs up the little kids. Stereotyping the image of the images, and this is what the image is. You buy a car, keep on stand, all of a sudden you are there in Indiana Jones. And I keep on the gold and keep on the scrolls and even the bird bones. Some of the worst paparazzi I've ever seen and I've ever known. With the world on the face of the world can see and it's all that we'll ever show.